Okay, my talk today. I was born to Lutheran parents. And they were happy because there was another Lutheran in the world. And I continued to be a Lutheran until I went to high school, which was in the 1960s. And then I realized it's better not to believe in anything and just become an agnostic, because you didn't have to define anything. You could just say agnostic and nobody knew what the heck you were talking about. And then, as time went on, I was soon to become 30. And I realized that people over 30 died quickly. And I needed a religion now so I could die well. So I bought a book by Houston Smith, World Religions. At that time, it was called The Religions of Man. He was wise in changing the title. And I read the whole book, and the chapter on Buddhism made the most sense. Sort of secular humanism, okay to be a guy. You were flawed, but there's a possibility of perfection. But I needed to learn how to meditate. So I got out the phone book, looked in the yellow pages, and I found a meditation center in the yellow pages where I now live, International Buddhist Meditation Center. They said, free instruction. Wednesday night, come and we'll teach you how to meditate. So on a Wednesday night, I went to the International Buddhist Meditation Center. That night, it was raining and it was cold. And they never turned on the heat. Don't know what was wrong with them. And they told us to sit on a little cushion, and the teacher, Shinzen Young, would be coming down the stairway after the meditation to give a Dharma talk. Now, I didn't know what Dharma was, but I was there, so I thought, I might as well listen to him talk about Buddhism or whatever. And so we had an hour and a half of meditation, with a five-minute break in between each 30 minutes. And it was the most excruciating thing I have ever experienced. I couldn't believe that, because I wasn't distracted by speech or anything else, my suffering became so apparent. You know, my mind was agitated, my back hurt, it was cold, my knees were suffering, my ankles felt uncomfortable. And I'm thinking, why the heck would anybody ever do this? What possible good could come from suffering for an hour and a half? And Shinzen made it clear during his talk that Buddhism is only about two things: why we suffer and how to end our suffering. Now I know why I suffered, and I was eager to hear how to end that suffering. So Shinzen gave a talk. Now Shinzen was this American guy who had been going to UCLA, and he was studying Japanese culture and language, and decided to go to Japan for sort of like advanced studies. And while he was in Japan, he became ordained as a Shingon monk. And when he came back to the United States, he was given a room at the meditation center. And he was teaching and eventually became the vice abbot, the second guy in charge. And so when I met him, I thought to myself, this is interesting, because this is an American guy who had converted to Buddhism and actually got ordained. And his first language was English, and mine was too. So I thought I could probably understand what he was talking about, but I didn't, because he was so esoteric, it was so poetic the way he would describe things. He'd point at the wall and say, you know, that wall is transparent. You can see right through it. And I'm looking at the wall, and it didn't look transparent to me. And what he was saying ultimately was, it's just a concept. Wall is a concept. Doesn't exist in any real way until we decide it does. And of course, we decide it does because we learn the language. And the language helps us intellectually understand something that doesn't exist in the way it's being presented. So I thought, wow, this is going to be heavy stuff. I'm going to have to look through the wall. But he inspired me because I wanted to see the world he did. I didn't necessarily at that point want to be a Buddhist, but I wanted to see the world differently. And he was seeing it in a really unique way. So around 1978, 79, I was soon to turn 30, and I decided to become an official Buddhist. And there's a little ceremony that you go through when you take the five precepts and the three refuges. And the five precepts are, I will practice not to take life. I will practice not to take what is not given. I will practice not to indulge in sexual misconduct. I will practice to speak skillfully and not speak unskillfully. And I will practice not to consume intoxicants. Five precepts. Three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. And I take refuge in the Sangha, the men and women who have become ordained and represent Buddhism in the world. And they gave me my name. They gave me Kusala. Kusala. I thought, wow, what does that mean? Is it good? He said, oh, it's really good. He says, it means that you're skillful and wholesome. But we gave you the name because you aren't. So every time somebody says your name, it's to remind you what direction you need to go in. I'm thinking, these guys are really clever. So I continued to practice and meditate. And then in 1994, my teacher suggested I get ordained. Why don't you get ordained? Your life is okay, but it could be better. You don't have much going on. You got an old car. Have you ever thought about getting ordained? And I hadn't. I thought, you know, that's what other people do. That's what people who deserve ordination because they've attained a level. But with time, I changed my perspective and I got ordained as a novice monk. And that was fine. That was 1994. 1996, I got ordained as a fully ordained monk. At that time in 1996, I got a certificate from College of Buddhist Studies. You know, and now I had this sort of intellectual stuff, and I had this ordination stuff, and I became somebody. I was somebody. I was a monk. Well, what do monks do? Well, I mowed the lawn. You know, I took care of the animals. At that time, we had dogs and cats and fish and birds, and I fed them every day. I was told in the beginning that it would just be temporary. You just have to feed them for maybe a year or so, and then somebody else would take over. But nobody's ever taken over. I've been feeding animals for 30 years. But you couldn't ask for a better practice than feeding animals. I was up this morning, 6 o'clock, feeding the cats. Sun's coming up, chilly, felt like weather, felt like Southern California cold. It was sort of nice. You know? But the thing I like about best in feeding cats is they never say thank you. They just walk away. And how wonderful is that? No ego boost with that. You're just sort of there. Well, that's what I was doing. And I started to give talks. I was invited to high schools to talk about Buddhism, Buddhism 101. And then something remarkable happened in 1997. Changed my life forever. I was invited to Cal Poly Pomona to speak to the Buddhist Club. It was a Chinese Buddhist club. And apparently they had heard about me and they wanted to hear what I had to say, sort of this American guy talking about Buddhism. And I didn't know it at the time, but there was an LA Times reporter and photographer there. And they were going to write a story about the Buddhist Club. And I was in it, and they took a picture. And if you're curious about the picture, it's on my website. You can go check it out. But I was thought, this is so cool. You know, now not only am I somebody, but I made it. I'm somebody that was in the LA Times. And how many people get in the LA Times? Not realizing that that was just the beginning, that wasn't the end of my journey. Now, about a month or two later, I get a phone call. Deacon Szymanski, California State Prison for Men. Gusla, I saw your picture in the paper. Hey, can you come up and help us? We've got Buddhist prisoners, and I'm the Catholic chaplain. I really don't know what to say to them. My answer was, you have Buddhists in prison? How could that be? Aren't they practicing the five precepts? So I went up and met the guys. They have a chapel in the compound, and they all seemed like really nice guys. I couldn't figure out how they got there until I found out some of the backstories, and then I was glad they were there. So for a year, I went to California State Prison for Men, and I learned a lot. You know, I learned that men in prison do not meditate with their eyes closed because they don't trust the guy next to them. They asked me if I would be able to change their diet for them. Could I speak to the warden? Because we've got terrible food. We want some fresh vegetables and fruits and some regular food. Can you speak to the warden for us? I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. I'm not here to change your diet. I'm here to change your mind. They weren't impressed with that at all. So after a year, I got another phone call. Mr. Noy Russell, Central Juvenile Hall, downtown Los Angeles. Kusala, I saw your picture in the paper. Can you come and help us? Now, by that time, I had found other volunteers to help me at the state prison, so I was free to travel to Juvenile Hall, downtown Los Angeles. And I gave my first talk in the high-risk offenders unit, and all the guys were sort of sitting down, all lined up and everything. And I looked at the audience, and I felt immediately comfortable because we all had the same haircut. Anyway, I can relate to you guys. Then I said, anybody know about Buddhism? Not one. Anybody know about suffering? Everyone's hand went up. Well, let me tell you about suffering and how to end the suffering. And I began there with my first talk. Now, I was at Central Juvenile Hall for 5 years, found other volunteers to help me. I would go into the classrooms to give talks. Now, it's weird, but when you go to Juvenile Hall, you still have to go to school. You don't get a free pass on that. So I'm going to the classroom one day, and the teacher, this sort of old woman about my age, looked at me and said, can I talk to you? Sure. Took me to the corner of the classroom. She says, you know, this is a public classroom. You cannot speak about God in this classroom. I said, no problem. I'm going to talk about suffering and the end of suffering. So we did that. And then I remember another occasion where I'm going from one unit to the next, and there was a Catholic volunteer. And there were a lot of Catholics in prisons and in juvenile halls, helping out. And so he saw me and he said, who are you? And I said, proudly, I am the Buddhist volunteer to come here to help the young people. And he said, have you found any Buddhists yet? And I went, whoa, where did that come from? Then I said, well, no, not yet, but everybody's suffering. And he said, that's why I'm here too, because everybody is suffering. So the third year I was there, I won the probation department Volunteer of the Year award and got a wonderful certificate. Now, they don't pay you, but you get some cool certificates suitable for framing. Now, during this time, I was asked to give a talk at the mayor's prayer breakfast to be keynote speaker at the mayor's prayer breakfast in Garden Grove, California. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. The mayor wants me to speak. So the office contacted me and we were talking, and I warned her. I said, you know, I don't pray, but I do eat breakfast. Is that okay? She said, that's fine. And I gave my talk, and a week later, the police department chief office called me and asked if I'd be interested in being a ride-along police chaplain. I thought, whoa, man, Cops is one of my favorite shows. This would be cool to be in that car with the officer, and we do police chases and stuff. Go get the bad guy and arrest him and stuff like that. Well, of course, it doesn't work like that, but that was how my mind was working. And I said, sure, I'd be glad to. She said, well, you'll need a uniform. And the uniform says chaplain on it. It's a sort of black jacket and shirt and hat says chaplain. And on the back of the jacket says chaplain. And I said, why is chaplain all over this, my uniform? And one of the officers said, well, you'll be the last one shot because you're a chaplain. They have a strange sense of humor, you know. But I wore my uniform. I even had a bulletproof vest. Put that on underneath, and we did the ride-alongs. And my job was just to sort of be the heart of the police car. So if something was happening and the officer needed to talk to somebody about something, I was there to talk to all the other people who were trying to figure out what the heck just happened. And my job was to sort of maybe not soothe them, but give them some perspective and give them some reference points about life. And of course, all I knew about life was suffering and the end of suffering, and it was just perfect situation for me. So I learned a lot. These men and women who put on that uniform every day and go out into the world, man, they don't know if they're coming back. And we never get to talk to good people when you're a police officer. You're always talking to people who have problems or situations that are problematic. And that's your whole reality at work. And now you got to go home and talk to your wife and have a good attitude and all of that good stuff. And I can remember, I ride along with the police officer. Now, they didn't know I was going to be with them. They just knew somebody was going to be riding along today. Garden Grove, they don't have a partner. They just ride along alone. And so I thought to myself, what are we going to talk about? I'm there 12 hours in the car with them. Never met him before. What are we going to talk about? A lot of times we talked about the new drapes they just got at the house. It was just regular stuff. They're human beings. They're, you know, it's just like, okay. So we talked about a lot of different things. And lunch break, we would go to certain places, and they never sat with their back to the door. Always back to the wall looking at the door. So there's all these little things that they do that I became aware of, and it's because of survival. They want to make it home that night, and they've learned how to do that. So I was there 7 years, and one of the things I found about volunteering is, when do you leave? When do you quit? When is it time to go? How do you ascertain that? And there's no set way to know. It's just sort of a feeling that you have that maybe 7 years is long enough. It could have been longer, but 7 years was good. Now, during that time, Reverend Piyananda from the Dharma Vijaya Buddhist Vihara, easy for me to say, asked me if I'd be interested in being a Buddhist chaplain at UCLA for the University Religious Conference. And I thought, wow, that sounds so cool. Hanging out with people that are smarter than I am. Yeah, I'll do it. Now, I was there 12 years. And I was there a long time. And again, I learned a lot. And of course, with the students, they come and go. You know, it's sort of like the prison. Well, maybe not the prison. Sort of like the juvenile hall. Well, they come and go. So you would meet the other chaplains, and you would, you know, share notes and talk about things that are happening on campus. And then the UCLA Medical Center found out I was there, and said, Kusla, would you be willing to come to talk to the medical center chaplains on Buddhist patient care and end-of-life issues? How do you die as a Buddhist? How do you live as a Buddhist? And what I came to understand with that was when you go to church, they usually don't tell you how to die. Their emphasis is on how to live well, how to be fulfilled, how to be good in all situations. Now, I was at the Pacific Unitarian Universalist UU Church just a couple months ago in Palos Verdes and gave a talk. And you know what they have every couple months? They have a meeting. It's called the Death Cafe. And they get together that day, and all they do is talk about death. I'm thinking, whoa, that is so powerful. Because we all have death in our life. If you're our age, my age, parents, grandparents, gone. If you have pets, cats and dogs, you're lucky to get 12 years. Gone. Everything's dying all the time. And all we focus on is what's living, which, of course, is the best way to do it, because we could be of service to those who are living. Not much we can do for those who are passed away. So I thought to myself, yeah, I'm going to emphasize the death and dying in Buddhism to help these chaplains when they get a Buddhist patient, because the Buddhists have rites and rituals during their death process and after their death that the family do. And so what an experience. 12 years, learned a lot, happy I did that. And then Rebecca Wilson. She was in between jobs a few years ago, a decade ago. She moved in to IBMC. We have rooms for rent. We have five old houses, most of them built in the 1910s and 15s, craftsman style. And we rent out rooms at the meditation center, and that helps us stay alive, you know, because there's property tax and there's maintenance and all. So they're doing that, and I started to realize why we have so many pets at the meditation center is because when they die, we hope they'll be reborn as a human being, move into the meditation center, and pay rent. So I have to see how that goes. So Rebecca moved in, and she was doing meditation, and I have a Dharma talk, and she'd, you know, come to the Dharma talk, and she said, Kusla, she said, you know, I've never met a monk who's done so much community service as you have. We should write a book about your community service, about instead of being Buddhism, doing Buddhism. Whoa. So we started, and then she got a job. She was Robert Thurman, digitizing information in New York at his Buddhist center. And then she got another job working for TED Talks. She was a producer. And so this book idea that she had was a good one. But she had to work. She had to find employment. And so we'd start. She'd take notes, we'd stop, she'd start, take notes. 9 years we worked on this book. You won't realize it when you read the book, but it was 9 years. And one day in the mail, I got the book, advance copy. And she called me up. Are you surprised? Are you surprised? I said, yeah. How did we get a book? I know we were working on it, but that was a decade. I finally found time to get it finished. And I read the book and I thought, this is perfect. This is not your average Buddhist book of how Buddhism works and what you need to do and how to meditate and who the Buddha was. It was about how to be in the world and make a difference rather than being in the zendo in meditation. And I had never thought of myself as a volunteer or someone who wanted to make a difference in the world, because I didn't have much to offer, you know? And then I became somebody. I became a monk. And people thought, well, he's a monk, he must have something to offer. Well, in Zen Buddhism, we offer nothing. That's our spiel. So I got good at doing that. And I realized in all these different situations I found myself in, my job was just to be there. I couldn't tell them what I was going to do. I had no clue. But I did tell them I'd show up. And I show up when I was supposed to. Give me a time and place, and I'll be there. And then we'll decide what I need to do, or what I should do, or what I could do, or what I shouldn't do. But show up. So I learned after years and years of being a volunteer and trying to make the world a better place, not because I wanted to, but because other people wanted me to, that it's just showing up. You got nothing to say, really. Some of these situations you find yourself in, you can't say anything to make it better. It's just a terrible situation. So your job is to listen, to be an open heart, to feel the pain, to feel the suffering, and not let it affect you in the way it's affecting them. And that's where Buddhist practice comes in. Buddhist practice allows you to go into a variety of situations and not take it home with you, not drive you crazy, not send you to another country because you can't stand yourself anymore, because all that stuff is inside you and it's boiling. You have to learn how to let go. Buddhism is all about letting go. Now at 76, I have to let go of life pretty soon. Don't know when, don't know how long, don't know what will happen, but it's the whole process of letting go. Every day is the first day. You have never had a day like today, ever. And tomorrow, it'll be the same thing. You will never have had a day like that. It's always the first day. This is exciting. This is the place we are. That sensation that you felt in that little meditation we did, that's your home. That's where you live all the time. So when it comes to worrying about death or life or money or no money, come to that present moment, feel the present moment, feel the sensation, and all of a sudden, you're just sort of there. Because fear comes out of the unknown. Anger sometimes comes from the past. But what happens in this present moment is special. And Ram Dass talked about it all the time. Be here now. Ram Dass just made a whole bunch of money off be here now. And that's where we always are. It's the best place we could possibly be. Best place. Now, you might wonder, well, do Buddhists go to hell when they die? Buddhists go to heaven when they die? We do. We have so many places to go. It's just not one place. So we have something called the six realms of existence. The first realm of existence is the heaven realm. Really good. Really cool, probably a lot like your heaven realms, except our heaven realm is temporary. We have to leave. Now, we could be there a few thousand lifetimes until it's time to go, but we always have to leave because everything in Buddhism is impermanent. Second heaven realm is not quite as good because there's desire and craving and attachment connected to that heaven realm. So you're never ultimately satisfied. It could always be just a little better. The third realm of existence is the human realm. Now, you may not be Buddhist, but you made it to the human realm, and how cool is that? And in the human realm, not only do we have a variety of religions, we have the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. You can't follow the teachings of the Buddha in heaven, because everything is perfect or close to perfect. There's no reason to change anything. But here, it's never perfect, and it's never ultimately terrible. It's just bad and good. So it keeps us working, keeps us engaged in the present moment. Now, the first hell realm is the animal realm. You may not think that's the case. If you have pets, that's not a hell realm for them. But there are a lot of pets who don't have you. And oftentimes the animal realm is described as always wanting to eat, always wanting to sleep, always wanting sex, and never being totally clear with clarity, always a bit confused. Now, that reminded me when I was a teenager in high school. That was like the first hell realm. I already was there. Now, the next hell realm is the hungry ghost realm. These giant creatures, 12, 15 feet tall, a little pinhole for a mouth. And no matter how hard they try to stuff food through their mouth, they're always hungry. It's just terrible. They're always looking for food. Sort of like a Macy's sale, 50% off. And you're just never satisfied because you can't be satisfied. And then we have the ultimate hell realm. The ultimate hell realm is when you materialize there looking sort of like you look. Everything seems fine. Walking through the forest, all of a sudden, the leaves on the tree turns into razor blades, falls, cuts you into a million pieces, you die in a horrible way. And then right on the spot, you're reborn again so you can die again and blah, 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 blah. Thankfully, it's not forever. You get to leave soon once your karma is purified. So you may wonder, do Buddhists have a soul? We don't, according to Buddhism. I was born in Iowa. Everybody in Iowa had a soul. How could I not have a soul, I said to myself. Well, the Buddha said, we have nothing that stands independent. Everything is interconnected and interdependent. So a soul would seem to be independent from you because it has to leave and go into the next lifetime if you're a Hindu, or go to heaven if you're a Christian. And there's no soul, but what we've changed now, because this is 2026, we've come a long way. So we never talk about not having a soul, like I just did. We talk about not having a self. And people go, no self? That's almost as bad as no soul. Yes, self is just a process, mind and body process that materializes. But it doesn't exist in any real way. It's just sort of combination of things, always changing. There's no independent self and there's no permanent self. It's just a process that keeps changing. And you can look at your life and realize, yeah, every day is the first day. Every day is different. Decades. I was this in one decade. I was this in another decade. Yeah, wow. But we had to go further because people wouldn't believe that there was no self. And if they did, it would just ruin their life. So what we come up with as Buddhists is we say, well, you have a self, but it's not really you. That's your relative reality. You need to know your zip code. That self is there so you don't forget your zip code. You need to know where you parked your car. That self is there because you can find your car. But ultimately, there is no self. Ultimately, everything is everything and is produced by everything. And I sort of like that idea because there's no oneness. I don't like the idea of everybody's one. That's so depressing. I'd much rather say we're all different, but we're all connected, which gives you permission to be individual and have your own opinions and ideas about stuff. And still realize, even with those ideas and opinions, you're still connected to everyone else. It's just they have different opinions. You know, well, what is the truth? Somebody might say. How do you find the truth in Buddhism? You find the truth through practice. But you can't talk about it because it's beyond words. Words are relative. Words are simply clothing of thoughts. So what are you going to do? Well, you're not going to talk about the ultimate. You're going to talk about your new car. People relate to that. You don't want to be pulled over by CHP and tell them you don't really exist in the way they think you do. That's not going to work. So you have to be somebody. And at the beginning of the talk, I talked about becoming somebody. And then I talked about doing, which is beyond being someone. It's doing something. And sometimes doing it makes you somebody, but sometimes you have to be somebody before you do it. And the idea in being and doing is to find the balance. There is a balance. So if you're not doing enough, get started. If you're being too much, tone it down. You don't need to be, you know, the ideal human being. You just need to be a human being. And you might have cool shoes, but it's okay not to have cool shoes. You still can do stuff. You just can't be stuff unless you have cool shoes. So I am going to stop there, but I want to thank you all for spending some time with me today. And I hope what I had to say made sense and maybe give you a couple ideas of what you could do in this world. And I know that you use do a lot, and that is so cool. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.